Now join me in prayer. Amen. One of the great theologians of the 20th century said we should always do our work of preaching the gospel with a Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other hand. And I have to tell you, these days, trying to keep up with the newspaper is as difficult as trying to keep up with the Bible. There's so much going on and so much to talk about, and every week I don't even know how I would get it all in. And we have other things to talk about, too, besides current events, the life of the church, the life of the souls of individuals on their pilgrimage. They're all things we need to touch on in the different sermons. But this week, there was one particular news story that was, you know, so obvious and so central to what we do as a Baptist church that I felt like I needed to talk about it. So I want to talk today about this Supreme Court decision a little bit, about the separation of church and state, about this cake baker who refused to make a cake for a same-sex couple in their wedding. It touches on the Baptist tradition of the separation of church and state. I always like to remind people, we invented that, the separation of church and state. That's our thing. And not because we think that we don't want the government's help, it's because we know that if the government tells you how to believe, it's not real belief. So we believe people should be protected from the government telling them how to believe. It touches on the ritual lives of our churches. I mean, marriage is one of the most wonderful things we do as a church. And frankly, it's one of the few things a lot of people come to church for. And so if we can offer a beautiful and loving ceremony to people, it will help them start their lives easily and better, but it will also help us feel more involved in the lives of the world around us. And it also pertains to the teaching of the gospel, as I will share. This whole question of what the right kinds of marriages are and how the state should be involved and who should be forced or not forced to bake a wedding cake for the wedding is very thorny, very complicated, and as I always say when I get to dabbling in First Amendment rights, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I don't understand, especially when it comes to religious liberty, all of the subtleties, because it often seems like what is against establishment is also pro-integration. I mean, it just seems like you can argue every topic in both ways. You remember the story, right? A same-sex couple in Colorado wanted to have a marriage. And the Colorado state government says they're allowed to have a marriage, says same-sex marriages are legal in the state of California, and in fact says discriminating against same-sex couples is illegal. So they went to a cake baker who makes, I guess, really nice wedding cakes and asked him to make a wedding cake for them. And he said no. He'd make them any other kind of cake they wanted. But he wouldn't make them a wedding cake because, as a Christian, he didn't believe in same-sex marriages. Now, we can quibble, or worse, with his definition of what it means to be a Christian. But as a Baptist, I want to defend his right to interpret the gospel as he feels called. So, the baker said, no, in my religious convictions, I won't bake this cake. The couple said, you're discriminating against us on the basis of sexual orientation, just like if you owned a lunch counter and you refused to let us sit at it because we were the wrong race. Or just like if we were a biracial couple and you refused to bake us a wedding cake on the basis of that. You're discriminating against us. So, the Supreme Court was asked to decide whether religious freedom includes the right to discriminate, not to put it too subtly. And the Supreme Court handed down its decision this week, and both sides claimed victory, and in truth, the court dodged the question entirely. They're getting very good at that. They find in favor of the cake baker. That's clearly what they wanted to do, to give this cake baker the right not to bake this cake. But they also wanted not to erode the protections against discrimination for people of sexual and gender minorities. So they fixated on the government panels, the legal government panels in Colorado who'd heard the case and decided that these panels were mean to the baker and insulted his religion. On that basis, they're found for the baker. So if there's a precedent here, it is that if you're on a governmental panel, don't be mean to religious people. I believe in the separation of church and state. And I have to tell you, I mean, people don't often think about it this way, but I have to tell you, I kind of resent the fact that I'm expected to serve both matters, the church and the state, to serve both masters when I perform marriage ceremonies. I think the original sin was that we in the church allowed the state to piggyback their legalities on top of our religious beliefs and our religious rituals. And I would be super happy with a world where everyone went to city hall and got civil unions and then went to whatever church they wanted to get it blessed in the bonds of holy matrimony. I've performed same-sex weddings and opposite-sex weddings. I've performed union services before same-sex weddings were legal. And they're all joyful, they're all beautiful, they're all wonderful occasions, regardless of the genders and the gender identities of the people involved. Partly that's because I just do really good weddings. But it's because the love is there, right? And I believe the government has no business telling me as a clergy person or telling this church as a religious institution whom we can and cannot marry as a religious ceremony. But we've been co-opted. I have the ceremonial power to declare people united in the bonds of matrimony, as well as the civic power of signing their marriage licenses and making it legal. And I wish I didn't have that second power. Because there are indeed some marriages I won't perform. I won't perform marriages in cases of exploitation or abusive relationships. I won't perform marriages for people who clearly have no idea what they're doing. So can the Supreme Court say that I should be compelled to perform those marriages because the law says they're legal? Can they sue me for discrimination on the basis of abusiveness or folly? You should also know that the whole marriage equality issue has been a very controversial one in some corners of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender movements. I call it the white picket fence problem. Much of the movement for marriage equality was driven by upper middle class, Euro-American, male, same-sex couples, seemingly in sort of a bid for respectability. And so they wanted to stretch the definition of what was respectable, but not always attacking the idea that society should use respectability as a measure for anything. The couple that was involved in this cake fiasco, their picture was in the New York Times this week. I don't know if you would have seen it, if you saw it, but it was just the kind of the icon of what I'm trying to describe here. One of the partners was seated in a chair with a beard, a masculine, resolute, strong gaze into the camera, while his partner stood behind him with a hand on his shoulder, smiling adoringly at him. It was the very icon of sort of a very traditional image of heterosexual marriage, right? It was a president and his first lady, or a captain of industry and his lovely wife. It was a recreation of the sort of iconography of what is most respectable. And it served a purpose to send the message that this is a couple too, even in the eyes of the old definitions, but it didn't serve the purpose of trying to describe a broader definition. So I struggle with the idea of starting with marriage equality as the starting place for the movement. I mean, you could make an argument that what's the number one challenge facing LGBTQ families today? Well, it's healthcare. So why isn't the movement focused more on healthcare, or focused more on racism, or focused more on educating people about how many different shapes life can take, or focused on employment discrimination. Why did it start here? Now, I don't begrudge the movement its victories, and I certainly don't want to deprive anyone of what they have gained in their own lives with their marriages. I love marriages, and they're beautiful. And the hope is that marriage equality will open the way for other forms of equality. And we've already seen that the marriage equality movement has opened space for a discussion about transgender people. We've already seen that incremental change sometimes leads to something more radical. But I was brought up always to yearn for the more radical. But there is another bit of wisdom in starting with marriage equality as the first tip of the spear kind of topic. And that's because it brings up the issue of family. And no matter how radical you are, you can't avoid the issue of family. Family, the way we make our lives together through life. Family, that group of people you are with as you make your life together. The whole marriage debate seems so narrow about what family can mean, but at least the issue is raised. We're talking about families here. At exactly the moment when families are evolving in lots of ways, not just in this way. For a long time now, we've lived with this image of two adults, a man and a woman, living together in romantic and sexual and economic and domestic partnership, the nuclear family. It's really kind of a new invention in the history of humanity. It's only about 60 years old, this nuclear family in this country, and mostly just in the middle class. But that, even that definition is breaking down, is broadening out. Wages have been flat for a generation, so people can't afford to live that nuclear family life anymore. It's expensive to live the nuclear family life. So that college kid we all like to joke about who returns home to live with his parents after graduation, there's nothing wrong with that. Or when mom, now a widow, moves home to be with her a child and their family, creating options for childcare, for tutoring, for housework that didn't exist before. My aunt and my uncle raised my cousin's kids because my cousins couldn't afford daycare. Is that defective? It was really quite beautiful, actually. And we all have these examples of these other kinds of families. My great aunt lived with the same woman for 30 or more years. They owned a house together, they traveled together, they did everything together as far as I know. I have no idea what to define them as or what to call them. Were they a couple? In so many ways they were. Were they a Boston marriage? They were a family, and they were part of my family. Or I think of close friends of mine, a lesbian couple and one of their, her brother, and a fourth roommate who lived together for like a decade. And they spent all their holidays together, all their celebrations together, because they couldn't go to their own homes, their own families, their families of origin, because they'd all been rejected. They'd all been kicked out. So they made a new family. Don't they deserve legal protections? Or I think about another friend of mine who's co-parenting her son with the child's father and his transgender partner. And there are things about this arrangement that my friend hates and things about it that she loves. But it's her family. And shouldn't her ability to get health care bleed over into her child or her child's parent? The movement uses this phrase, families of choice, in distinction from families of origin. Families of origin, wonderful if you've got a good one, but lots of people don't. Lots of people have been rejected, shut out, shunted away because they ended up transgender, or because they ended up lesbian or gay, or because they wanted to marry a nice Jewish boy or a nice Muslim boy, or because of any number of things they did wrong in the eyes of the family. So many people can't go home to that family of origin. Why shouldn't there be a strong safeguard, strong protection, strong support for families of choice? And if you want the nuclear family arrangement, great and amen, and I will perform your wedding, and I know someone who will make you the most fabulous wedding cake ever, no matter who you are, honestly. But legal marriage and genetic ties are not the only definition of a family. When I meet with people, what I want to hear in premarital counseling is, do you choose each other? Do you choose one another? Do you love one another? Whether it's same-sex marriage or traditional marriage or extended family or roommates. I've never done premarital counseling with roommates, but I know a lot of roommates who could use some premarital counseling. Friends with benefit, polyamory, co-parenting, traditional nuclear family. I mean, there's just so many different ways human beings live. And it's so sad when we pretend like that's not true. How I wish the Supreme Court faced a case about this in the broader sense, the right you have to pick your own family, to define the group of people with whom you make your life, yourself, your family of choice. How I wish that the decision read, A, people can live however they choose to live, and it's not our decision to say otherwise. And B, this narrow-minded baker can do what he wants. I could have lived with that. The Supreme Court can't listen to theological arguments. That definitely would violate the separation of church and state. But if I had been allowed to file a theological brief, a friend of the court brief, this is what I would have said. Jesus was talking to a big crowd, and there wasn't any room in the house. So when his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, seeing him, they called to him. The crowd sitting around him said, "Your mother and your brothers and your sisters are outside asking for you." And Jesus replied, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking around them at the people gathered around them, him, he said, "Here are my mothers and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and my sister and my mother. This is my family. Who are my mother and my brothers, my sisters?" Was he really like this to his family in private? We don't know. Or was he just making a teaching point for us? We don't know. But we should learn the teaching, right? Who's my family? He said, "Whoever does the will of God, that's my family. Whoever does the will of God is my brother, my sister, my sibling, my mother, my father." And who is it that does the will of God? Well, you know the answer, right? Jesus says, "No one has ever seen God. I came that you might know God's will. And I give you a new commandment, that you love one another." Jesus gives us an example, I think, even in his own family. What's Jesus's family? I kind of think it's actually Mary and Martha and Lazarus, who he's always going to visit, who he's always going to see, for whom he's always weeping and his heart is always breaking. They disappoint each other. Jesus disappoints them. They disappoint him. They come and they go. They share their griefs and their joys together. They stay together through death and tragedy. And in love, Mary is there at the very foot of the cross. So who is your family? Who are your mother and your father, your brothers, your sisters, your siblings, your other mothers and fathers, your extended, your relations, the mean lady who lives next door to you, who loves you and helps you, the weird friends who always show up just at dinner time, your fellow travelers on life's journey? Who's your family? If you'll get out your bulletins and look at the cover, I always try to find a picture that illustrates something, and this was the darndest topic to find a picture for. I looked up families of choice. I Googled it. I'm not a very imaginative Googler, so I just enter my sermon title, and I got all these pictures of couples with kids, right? And I got nothing against kids, but that's not what we're talking about today, right? Same-sex couples with kids, heterosexual couples with kids. So I just kept scrolling and kept looking. Oddly enough, I got all these pictures of medical practices. I don't know why. Maybe a medical practice wants you to think of them as a family. But I finally stumbled across this picture. It's not perfect, but there's some things about it I just love, right? This fellow at the center, I'm assuming he's ill, right? He's sick in bed, and his family of choice is gathered around him. And they're doing what families do. They're arguing, they're playing games. One person's checked out with their head resting on a pillow. There's a couple of aliens, or maybe just cosplayers, it's hard to know. It's a diverse group of people. I love this man at the far left who's wearing stocking feet, like maybe he lives in this home too. And they're having their card game, and they're bearing witness to each other. They're being present with each other. To me, it's not perfect, but that's not a bad image of what a family of choice can be. People who choose to be together because they love each other, and in that love, to serve one another. Your family is those people with whom you fulfill God's will and commandment that you love one another. So I ask you today, just what I asked the kids, who's your family? Amen.